afternoon. You are joining We the People Radio with Aaron Ryan.
And Bill Cundiff.
And Bob Martin.
We're all back. Sorry about the little interruption last week. Got busy at work. Thought you'd enjoy listening to Jim Beers again about wolves. And that topic's coming up again later in the month. There is, I'll post it on the website. I didn't even think about it, but there is a congressional hearing on the, now I'm going to use the term loosely, wolf management practices by federal agencies.
Or lack thereof.
Now, yes. Now, we all know that's not really being managed, but that's what it's called anyway. Had to call it something. So I'll post that. That's on the 21st, and if I remember correctly, that's like 11 o'clock in the morning Pacific time. So that should be fun for everybody. Today, we're chatting with Elaine Willman. You can find all of her information along with, did I do it? Yes, previous shows, I linked them properly, on our webpage at wethepeopleradio.us, and I think you'll like it. So it's 9/11, just, you know, in case you're actually listening today. Always a little strange. We get to the radio station, and there's a Penske truck right out front.
I was afraid to say anything.
It's like, what the heck's with the Penske truck out front? But it's Bob's. It doesn't have fertilizer in it or anything.
I checked it. It wasn't ticking.
Yikes. That was a little weird. It's funny how this particular day, it doesn't matter how many years go by, it's still a little weird and sad. So, anyway, I guess that's
I'm not leaving town, by the way. Just have a load of furniture to move this afternoon.
Just how you do it today, because all the other days are full and busy. No, nothing like a nice little drive to Susanville in your rented truck with furniture in it. All right, so today we're talking about federal Indian policy, and I know we've done this before, so you're thinking, oh, not again. But you know what? I think you're going to like it. Elaine's article is entitled Warpath. Obama's Indian policy threatens all Americans, both tribal and non-tribal citizens. And I think you'll find this information a little bit different spin than things that we've discussed previous. And Elaine, I've got a bunch of information about her. I won't read it all to you. But she's the author of two really super books, Going to Pieces, The Dismantling of the United States of America. That was published back in 2005. And it reports on first-person visits and experience of tribal members and citizens residing on or near 17 Indian reservations during her extensive road trip across the country from Washington State to New York. Her book is actually selling faster. This was from last year. It's actually selling faster in 2015 and 16 than when she initially published it because of the fears expressed in the book are now America's reality. And those of us living in the West know only too well. I don't want to shortcut her second book because it's really, I don't know if I should say it's more important, but I think it's an important book. Slumbering Thunder. It's a primer for confronting the spread of federal Indian policy and tribalism that's overwhelming America. And just in case you think this is going to be We Hate Tribes, her mom and her grandmother were both enrolled Cherokee members, and her husband is Shoshone ancestry and a direct descendant of Sacagawea. So there you go. Everybody
There's some heritage.
Yeah, you can't call us haters exactly. Well, you can call us haters. You just can't call Elaine a hater.
I sent my DNA in the other day. I might be part Indian. I'm going to find
you
out.
You did send it in? That's nice. Nothing like voluntarily giving them your DNA.
Yeah.
Right on, Bill.
Might be somebody just like me out there someday.
It's like last night we went to an NRA
dinner. Turns out he's related to Elizabeth Warren.
One or the other. You can't have both.
He's driven a Cherokee before. Yeah, last night, speaking of giving away information, we were at an NRA dinner, and instead of filling out your little ticket stub for your drawing, they wanted you to give them your driver's license. And then they gave you the drawing tickets.
They swiped the barcode on the back of your driver's license, which seemed a little unnerving.
Everybody was sitting there going, should we give them this? I guess it's the NRA. I guess that's good. Maybe. I don't know. It was weird. So nothing is as it seems. And I think by the time we get done with you today, you'll realize nothing is as it seems. So, hi, Elaine. It's, later afternoon for you?
Good to visit with you again.
Oh, we're doing fantastic. How's the weather out there?
Well, it's a beautiful, beautiful, sunny, big Montana blue sky day out here in the middle of nowhere, Montana. Up on the range, so to speak. But I'm in a very somber mood, and perhaps it is September 11th. I'm in this lumbering thunder mood, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
So I feel more philosophical than technical today.
Well,
there's lots of things I'd like to talk about.
We read your article again before we came in today, and Bill highlighted most of it.
Well, there's so much of it that's really disturbing. I mean, as far as what our government is electing to give away just because they can, and nobody seems to want to do anything about it.
It is, and you know, we are the prized country on the planet. We truly are. And we who live here are most fortunate. But we're also the bullseye target of a large, you know, tin hat, but it's real, globalization and one world order strategy. And, you know, we're a country that's only 227 years old. Most of our countries on the earth are a lot older than we are.
Oh, sure.
And we're still a country that is, I think, learning by skinning its knees. We do some things really right, and we've done some things really wrong. And I guess where I'm kind of at today is my mind is thinking, where are we going to go from here? And how does this fit with federal Indian policy and the escalation of the power of tribal sovereignty? I kind of think I'd like to talk about, what is this thing called tribal sovereignty today, if that's okay with you guys?
Yeah, we actually called the show is Tribal Sovereignty Constitutional, so we sort of set the stage. We haven't really, we didn't dig into that the last time we spoke with you.
Yeah, it's come about for the classic two reasons. The empowerment of tribal sovereignty has come about from the classic driving forces in our country and most others, and that's power and money. You know, it's really about power and money. But the reality of tribal sovereignty is what Justice Clarence Thomas has called in at least two and maybe more U.S. Supreme Court rulings, one back in 2004 and one just this past summer of 2016 in a case called U.S. v. Bryan. Justice Clarence Thomas challenges his fellow justices and Congress, and he says, show me where is the plenary power of Congress over Indian tribes. Show me where in the Constitution that's there. And he says, you won't find it in the Indian Commerce Clause. Congress has the power over Indian commerce, not Indian tribes. And you won't find it in the Treaties Clause. He said it's not in the Constitution. And so he calls federal Indian policy a fiction, an absolute fiction. That's in his language in that U.S. versus Bryan case. And Justice Scalia shared those views, but we lost him. And there are others that are coming on, other justices that are beginning to see that we have to deal with this. Where I'm coming from is I would just love it if a day could come in our American future where we're Americans, where we're not hyphenated Americans anymore, and we can be respectful of everyone's culture, cultures, and the folks can preserve them, their cultures and traditions because they want to, not because the federal government is demanded to pay for it.
Correct, and elevated them above some others.
Yeah.
Hey, Elaine, we've got to take a really quick break here, and we need to call you back because there's something funky going on your line.
Okay.
It keeps...
It might just be that I have it on speakerphone.
It sounds like you're doing a little electroshock therapy on the side.
Yeah, that speakerphone could be the problem.
I could probably use it.
Yeah,
we weren't going to get into that.
We'll take a quick break, and we'll call you back, Elaine.
And we'll be right back.
Okay.
So you're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
They take over, but good. an Indian outlaw. Half Cherokee and Choctaw. My baby, she's a Chippewa. Oh, she's a one of a kind. All my friends call me Bear Claw. The village chicken is my pawpaw. He gets his orders from my mama. She makes him walk the line. You can find me in my wigwam. I'll be beating on my tom-tom. Pull out the pipe and smoke you some. And pass it around. Cause I'm an Indian outlaw. Half Cherokee and Choctaw. My baby, she's a Chippewa. She's a one of a kind.
I like that song. It's always nice when you come on, Elaine. We can play all those songs.
I know. I love the bumper music. You guys are great with that.
Well, it's got nothing to do with us. We're on the dumb side of the table where you only use your mouth. It's at the other side of the table where all the buttons are that Bob controls.
Elaine, talk to us about when this transformation started. Was it '98 when they started passing these Indian laws or tribal laws?
Oh no!
It was Supreme Court.
The first trigger was back in 1934, when Congress passed the Indian Reorganization Act, and that was an act that John Collier, the BIA commissioner then, who's a communist and avowed communist and author of many communist books, but he ran the BIA, and it was his belief that the American Indians were much better off rather than becoming citizens, which they had been made by Congress in 1934, 10 years earlier. Collier thought it was just better for American Indians to live amongst themselves on Indian reservations and communally rather than to be citizens, property owners, landowners, and fully assimilated as had been the plan for decades before. So that was a triggering point. And the key word here is Indian Reorganization Act. In 34, there were about 70 tribes that the federal government was dealing with across the country. And these tribes were going to be reorganized to live amongst themselves. They were going to stop. It opened up all the reservations to settlers and everybody else. They were going to stop that process and let the tribes recoup what land they could and live amongst themselves. Reorganization for about 70 tribes. We now have 567 tribes, and the bulk of those got their federal recognition not long after 1988. You know why? 1988 was the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, and all of a sudden, these tribes came out of the woodwork and became tribes to get into the Class 3 gaming business, tax-exempt gaming.
Now, is that gaming? Is that
a help from...
Is that Gaming Act, when they get into this, the gaming business, is that subsidized by the federal government?
All of their basic life needs are, their housing, health, law enforcement, courts, education, all of the basic services for the tribal government, for their people, is provided by the taxpayer. So this gaming revenue is free money.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very, very much free money, and that has been used to create the power. First, we moved from about 70 tribes to 567 tribes. Then they had all this huge money. In the early years of gaming, it was 20, 30 billion a year. All this huge money that was what I call their free money, and they literally bought high-paid lobbyists that wandered the halls of Congress and their state capitals. They bought legislators, literally, because they're the only governments in the country that can write checks to political parties or candidates.
Yeah, I read that in your article. You mentioned that they're the only entity that can actually write checks directly to political parties and directly to candidates. And nobody else can do that. Boy, that sounds like it gives them a pretty heavy hand in our government.
Yes. That is the political power and the money power that I'm talking about. And there was a 10-year period of time, not long after, just right around, just before the Bush-Gore presidential election, just before 2000, or in May of 2000, had a little three-member federal advisory committee called the Federal Election Commission,
mm-hmm.
the FEC, and a tribe in New York asked the FEC if they could contribute to political parties. And that little three-member advisory commission responded to the Oneidas of New York and said, well, we agree that you are a government for purposes of your governance and federal subsidies, but you are a person for purposes of elections. And that was one little advisory opinion that went out to one little tribe in New York.
And that's never been challenged.
All tribes the same. Pardon?
Never been challenged?
Nope, never been challenged, and we have to treat all tribes the same. And so 567 tribes can take taxpayer money funded for their subsidies or their gaming revenue and send it into PACs or both political parties, both. This is very bipartisan. They cover all bases. Or county commissioners or city council members or state legislators. And that's why I say in the New American article that I wrote that they own Salem, they own Olympia, they own Helena and Boise. They own the state capitals politically. They truly have an inordinate power in our four northwestern states when their population in those states is less than 3% of the population. I think there's 13 million people in the four states.
And that's really...
The American Indians is less than 3% of it.
That's really an amazing closed loop there. I mean, we give them federal and state funds, and then they can turn around and give it right back to the politicians directly,
yeah.
Which it just kind of feeds itself. And why would they ever want to change that?
Well, it doesn't matter if it comes from the federal and state money or if it comes from gaming, because they never get audited, right?
Right. Nobody's looking. Nobody's looking. The Indian Self-Determination Act, I think it was 1975, where the government said, we're going to give you the monies every year, and we're going to let you self-determine how you spend them. And so there's little to absolutely no auditing. Huge dollars that go out to all these tribes.
Wow.
Just imagine 29 federal agencies annually funding 567 tribes. This is all taxpayer dollars going out to the tribes. A very small population, very small enrolled members. And the quality of life is not changing. It's still poverty and lack time on reservations for the tribal families. They're not benefiting from it. But those who have benefited from political contributions are the ones in office, and they're the least likely to change this. So it's a big problem.
Well, then also, too, I noticed you mentioned the 1998 executive order by Clinton to put an Indian agency or Indian office in every single federal agency, and they need to be consulted before those agencies move.
And it's for consultation. And it's only consultation, which is appropriate. And I don't really have a problem with any agency who's going to be doing a project or program on or near an Indian reservation consulting. That seems very, very appropriate. But when you add huge money and political power, and then you add in a little national guilt, you stole the land, we were here first, and then you add in the fact that no elected official likes to be called a racist, they get pretty much everything they want out of our elected officials. They truly do.
Mm-hmm.
They truly do. No tribal government makes federal Indian policy. They benefit from it, but they don't make the decisions. Our state legislators, our Senate and House, or the courts, or the executive branch, are American leaders federal Indian policy. That the consultation with tribes gives them their direction. And the direction going on right now is a horrific expansion of tribal jurisdiction replacing state jurisdiction, of tribal governance over non-tribal persons and properties, where none of that is allowed in their tribal constitutions, but the feds are delegating their jurisdiction and states are delegating their jurisdiction to tribes so that tribes can govern you and me. We can't go to the feds, we can't elect their officials. But this transfer of physical jurisdictional authority to tribal governments is really taking over the four northwestern states.
Yeah, that's the really that's disturbing
the
part.
Yeah, I was going to say most of the western states. We need to take another really quick break here, and we're going to try something different with the phone because it's still. Can you hear that?
Yeah, I can hear a little ticking every now and then, but the weather is very clear here, and my phone's in very good shape.
I talked to you yesterday for like 2 hours. And
I know.
There was like no bad sounds whatsoever.
Yeah.
Hang on the line, and we'll have.
I'll try something else. I had it on a charger, so I just took the charger off. So,
it's still doing it.
Not helping.
Huh. Isn't that bizarre?
Did you say you were on a speakerphone, Elaine?
No.
She took that off.
No.
Took that off? Pretty soon she's going to have to stand with, on one, like you do at, we do up at your mom's house. You know, you got to stand on one foot with your hand out the window and blinking your eyes rapidly. It's terrible.
She could always send smoke signals.
Bob said you could always send us smoke signals.
We'll translate them on the same.
We have fires everywhere. Forget the smoke signals. Hang on the line, and you and Bob can chat about the connection, and the rest of us will listen to some nice commercials. Okay. We'll be right back with you.
Land, lots of land under starry skies above. Don't fence me in. Let me ride through the wide open country that I love. Don't fence me in. Let me be by myself in the evening breeze. Listen to the murmur of the cottonwood trees. Send me off forever, but I ask you, please, don't fence me in.
Surely I'll be there to shake your hand. Surely I'll be there to share the land that they'll be giving away when we all live together. I'm talking about together now. Maybe I'll be there to shake your hand. Surely I'll be there to share the land that they'll be giving away. We all live together. I'm talking about together now.
And we're back. You're listening to We the People. We're here with Elaine Willman, chatting about federal Indian policy. And I hope you'll go to the website and read the entire article from the New American that she just put out at the end of August. You can find that at wethepeopleradio.us. Okay, how's our connection, Elaine? Is it better?
Well, I think it's... We made another effort. I just phoned in.
Oh yeah, it sounds
better.
Sounds a lot better. Hey, one of the things I was reading in your article here, we were talking about how much money the federal government gives the tribes, and you mentioned here that the cumulative annual dollars are likely equivalent to the annual federal defense budget. That gives you kind of an idea how much money we're talking about here.
And it has never, ever been audited.
Yeah, that's amazing. Because
that
is a ton of money.
We asked the top dog at the Bureau of Indian Affairs back in around 2006, I think it was, George Scabeen. He was the go-to guy at the BIA for at least 30 years. And he was a keynote speaker at a conference I attended. He was asked if the federal government had ever audited how many annual dollars go out to the tribes from the various agencies. And he said, well, we tried that once, but we just couldn't do it. And the follow-up question was, don't you think you should? And his response was, well, I don't think it's necessary.
Oh, absolutely
not. But
if you do the math,
567 times 29 federal agencies, and they all get many multi-millions every year. That's a lot of money since 1934, actually since 1855. Our American Indians are the only ethnicity that has received annual federal resources every single year. And those resources are off the charts now.
Why do you suppose they're not required to audit?
Because of their sovereignty. Federal government's supposed to leave them alone.
Once we give them the money, that's theirs. They can do what they want.
Yeah,
we don't look back.
They have self-governance. So it's like, just give us the money, we'll do with it what we want.
So we siphon it off the working people.
They siphon it off their own members more than anything else.
Then there's that.
The gaming money, the purpose of the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act was for economic development to improve the quality of life on Indian reservations for the tribal members. Now, that's not happening. It's just not happening.
Well, you'd think it'd happen just with the money that we give them. I mean, if it's that much money, you'd think that would be enough to make life a little easier for them. I mean, you know, even though there are 567 tribes, you'd think that that money would spread out and give a pretty good hand up.
And there are legitimate tribal, there are legitimate Indian tribes, and then there are those, and California is a classic example of over, I don't know how many casinos they have in California, but all of a sudden California just burst forth with federally recognized tribes with an enrollment of maybe 3 people, 5 people, 20 people.
Yeah, we've got a casino on every corner.
Well, I was going to ask you that. Is there a requirement to how many people, you know, can constitute a federally recognized tribe?
Yeah, what's the requirements to become a recognized tribe?
Well, none of the tribes are huge populations. I mean, we have 324 million Americans today in the country. And for those who mark the census box as Native Americans, that's maybe 2 million. And of those, most of them aren't enrolled. There's maybe a little over 1 million that are actually enrolled in a tribal government. So we're talking a little over 1 million American people that are tribally enrolled in a tribal government, one of 567. So these are not large populations. And I don't think most listeners understand that Indian reservations were long ago opened up, and they're predominantly non-Indian. And in the California area, my favorite story is we've helped for years, some folks in Amador County, where there's a tribal, the American gaming industry really pushes this. We thought originally that they would be adversarial to tax-exempt Indian gaming. No, they saw a gold mine. And so rather than Las Vegas and Tahoe and Atlantic City, we now have what I call McDonald's for the mob. You have India, you have tribal casinos all across the country. And so the American gaming industry goes for it. They will go to the tribal and say, we'll help you get federally recognized. We'll pay for that. We'll help you get federally recognized. We will plan and build and pay for your casino, and we will train your employees. And we'll just take a 7-year management contract from you. And boom, 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 California just burst forth with Class 3 casinos of tribes of very small numbers.
Well, there's no incentive for the politicians to not do that if they know on the backside they're going to end up reaping a lot of the rewards from that.
Exactly, exactly. And that's the money wheel. And to me, the tragedy is giving a really tarnished image of wonderful tribal families and Indian people. I mean, there was a time when I was growing up, there was a time when there was a genuine respect for the American Indians and for our history, and, you know, regardless of the mutual pain we all went through, there was a genuine respect. But with what's going on in California and in other places, now we have these what we call casino Indians. And some of those with a very small membership are getting something like $30,000 a month from gaming. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But most of the tribal governments and the tribal families are getting zip. Zip.
And there's no, they decide within their own organization how the money is divvied up?
Not exactly either. The tribal constitutions, that when they are federally chartered as an Indian tribe, their tribal constitution do not recognize the U.S. Constitution. So when they elect leaders, and very often these leaders are families or what they call clans, the leaders will swap chairs, but the leadership usually stays the same over time. A tribal member that disagrees or tries to change reality on the reservation can face very serious repercussions. They don't have the Bill of Rights. They're full U.S. citizens off the reservation, but under their tribal government, they do not have the Bill of Rights. There is an Indian Civil Rights Congress that was doing a wonderful thing when it passed the Indian Civil Rights Act. And, aren't we good? Now we've helped our tribal families. But they put no enforcement mechanism in that Indian Civil Rights Act, so it's toilet paper, you know. And so the tribal members get retaliation if they disagree with whatever their government is doing. And here, on this flathead, I've lived on 3 reservations, and all 3. I've worked with I have a lot of tribal family friends, and I've worked with those who have experienced that retribution severely, really severely. There's a couple here in Montana that disagree. They stood up and they did not want their tribal government getting a major hydropower dam. And they were very courageous because their tribe, they just didn't think their tribe could handle it. They're very courageous to stand up and say so. And then they got a knock on the door from the Tribal Child Protective Services telling them, you're bad parents, and they haven't seen three of their girls in 19 months. You know?
Wow.
That was for standard. So the rest of them, they can lose housing, they've lost jobs, they lose children. You don't sit with, we speak, I speak, and I mean this sincerely. I speak for the tribal members that contact me or some of my colleagues. When they reach out quietly and tell us what's happening and they need help, there's very little help we can offer them, but I can sure the heck speak for them and talk about the reality of life under a tribal government. It's, with a rare exception, it's really tough. It's a hard row.
Elaine, how does it work? You mentioned them owning a utility. How does that work if they're not required to abide by public safety and what is it, the Homeland Security Acts? How does that work? How could they actually, I mean, they could run a dam, they could run, if something goes wrong, it's they're not responsible.
Something's already gone wrong up here. They own the former Kerr Dam, major hydropower dam that's called the Black Start Dam, meaning if that dam, if all the dams in the Northwest were to collapse or go, be out of commission, this dam is deep enough it can restart itself and power up the other dams.
Oh.
And this little tribal government owns it now, or manages it now. It's in trust for the tribe. This is one of Obama's new deals. The previous administrations, Bush and Clinton and Bush Sr., the previous administrations have been very, very generous with tribal governments, but Obama has just knocked himself out. In 2010, he decided that America's power grid, you know, this is for all 324 million of us, America's national power and energy grid would be really good economic development for tribal governments. And so billions, literally billions with a B, have gone out in training programs. They're pushing, the administration is pushing tribal governments to go acquire dams and electric facilities and the energy grid. Now, isn't that cute? Because they don't answer to our Constitution. They don't have a duty to non-enrolled people. And they're it's just polka dotting the country with placing our major energy grid at some, you know, some risk.
Well, sure. If they're not required to follow safety, national safety standards, national homeland security standards, how in the heck could they be involved with something as important as our power grid?
Exactly. Well, because this president thinks it's just great economic development for Indian tribes. It's that simple and that ugly.
Boy, that is.
It really is.
That does not sound good to me. I don't know.
No, it is not, you know. So, and then it gets a little worse if we look back in history and realize that when the West was being settled and these dams were going in and power services were going into the Western states, a Secretary of Interior, A.B. Fall, required that all these power and water facilities be located on or near Indian reservations over 100 years ago. So when you look at Hoover Dam or Grand Coulee Dam or any of the big dams in the country, you will find they are within an Indian boundary or right next to them. Now, that allows the federal government to keep a foothold on the water and power in the West. And see, what's going on now is we've always heard about this revisionist history.
Yep.
What's going on now is history is getting reversed, intentionally reversed.
Mm-hmm.
By the executive branch, and with the sanctions, the cooperation of the Senate and Congress. I mean, the Senate and Congress passed the Indian Energy Policy Act. They had to agree to it, and they did. And that goes back to that power and money.
And when did that happen?
2010.
Indian
Energy Policy Act, yeah. Yeah. Now, the newest game, and they're playing a very serious hide the ball as we speak. The newest game is they're just passing a big omnibus Indian energy appropriation bill for this whole thing. Another one. And some of my colleagues and I located literally dozens of forest management act revisions. And within these bills in front of Congress right now, these dozens of them, is the plan to transfer the management of our national forests to tribal governments if their reservation is within 100 miles of a national forest. And they're thinking that that is a good solution to the management of our forests. Now, the wicked thing about that is that the guys doing it, one is a congressman in Arkansas. His bill is moving rather quickly. There's maybe one or two small national forests in Arkansas and one or two tribes. So it has little impact on his constituents. And then there's a senator, Westerman, in Kansas, on the Senate bill. And again, one or two small national forests in Kansas and maybe one or two tribes. Very little impact. But look at Washington. Look at all the rest of the western states.
Oh, yeah.
And where the national forests are and where most of the tribal governments are. And so when we started screaming about those bills, they played hide the ball. They've now eliminated and shuffled around and tucked the Forestry Management Act into the middle of this Indian Energy Policy Act and appropriation bill, and we just discovered it, and we're trying to stop it. Again, the forest has two things besides timber and the public recreation that we all need to be able to participate in. It's also the very headwaters, the snowpack. It's the headwaters of America's waters. And so where we've already got these huge water settlement acts where the tribes are getting control of all the rivers and tributaries and whatnot, getting management of our forests gives them all the waters, beginning with the first snowflake up on top of a mountain. And it gives them the ability to say, well, okay, you can come in and visit the forest. You can walk this trail, but you can't. Well, we're closing this off because they have no duty to anyone but their enrolled tribal members.
So they're transferring
this is horrific.
They're transferring the management, but not the ownership.
No, they'll keep it in trust. The United States will keep it in trust. The United States will continue to own the land, but the tribal government will have the jurisdiction and the management of the land.
So we'll continue to pay for it, and then they can tell us whether or not we can use it or not. That's beautiful.
Right.
Yeah.
See, and it's funny because it depends on where you are in the country, but some tribes actually log and do those kinds of things, and they have far less restriction than the rest of us do, which is crazy on the face of it.
Yes, you're right, Aaron. Some tribes do forest management extremely well.
We have the guys up north of us who we better take a quick break before I launch into that tirade.
Okay.
We'll be right back. We're here with Elaine Willman. We're talking about federal Indian policy. And for those of you that are a little behind the curve on that and you wonder what the heck is going on, she's got two fantastic books that we would definitely recommend. And at the very least, tune into some of the shows we've done with her and read the articles. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Got to know when to hold up, know when to fold up. walk away and know when to run. You never count your money. When you're sitting at the table, there'll be time enough for counting when the dealing's done.
There's no way they got enough time to count all that money.
Well, then why would you? You're not being audited.
That's right.
Hey, Elaine, in your article, there's one part that we kind of, I don't know if we skipped over it, we just kind of went around it, but you said here, politics and perception have created the perilous false reality that tribal sovereignty is superior to the sovereignty of states.
Yes. Yes, and thank you for reminding me of that, Aaron, because that is the political perception, and I think that that is kind of the American public's perception, that tribal sovereignty is superior to all other sovereignty. But within our Constitution, this is where Justice Clarence Thomas is coming from, there's only three sovereignties, and they're in order. They're in priority. The first sovereignty is yours and mine as a citizen. It's the popular sovereignty. That's the priority. That's why we have the Bill of Rights and the Ten Amendments. That's the citizens. The second sovereignty is the states. We have to remember it was the 13 states that created the federal government. So their sovereignty is second. The third sovereignty is the sovereignty of the federal government that was created by the states. There is no other sovereignty within the U.S. Constitution. And that's why Justice Thomas says, where is it? Where is your plenary power? Where is this tribal sovereignty in the U.S. Constitution? It is not there. But this has been such a propaganda machine that really escalated when the money came in from Indian gaming and stuff like that, that folks just assume that tribal sovereignty is superior. And again, a lot of that is that, you know, we're a generous heart. American public is a generous heart. We take on false guilt quite easily. I mean, they were here first. Oh, my God, we should do penance forever. That kind of a thing. It's very, very psychologically and politically persuasive. And so we all think, oh, well, we have to help the poor Indians. And all these high-paid lobbyists just barrage the halls of Congress and go in and wring their hands and say, my people, my people, and they get more. And it's just a vicious circle. So the other problem is our state governments, and it started with Washington State, with old Governor Jim Lowry. The states have no fiduciary duty or trust relationship with tribes. That's only the federal government, unless a state self-imposes one, which is what Governor Lowry did in 1989, 1 year after the Gaming Act, for Washington State. And that's the governors here in Montana have self-imposed a trust relationship with the tribes here in Montana. I would bet money the same thing's true in Oregon. I don't think Idaho has. But most of our states have self-imposed a trust relationship with these tribal governments. So we now have double dipping. Montana spends millions of state taxpayer dollars and rolls it out to these seven little tribes. Montana has an Indian office in every state agency, as does Washington, and I'll bet money, as does Oregon. And so here you have this federal, you know, money machine, and now you have state money machines rolling dollars out to these tribal governments because, of course, tribal sovereignty is so important. Our citizen sovereignty, getting our property rights wiped out, and our state sovereignty, they're sacrificing their own state sovereignty, but there's some good news on this that we're coming across. And one is a state official, not a governor, not a county commissioner, not the attorney general, a state official may not violate or erode the state's authority under the 10th Amendment. That 10th Amendment, it linchpins the state's sovereign authority under the Constitution to keep a balance between state governments and the federal government. So where all these fools in the states, and I'm just speaking of the governors of these states who have condoned this and benefited from this, they have all said, we're gonna set up a trust relationship and start doling out taxpayer dollars, state dollars, to these tribes to and it's really not legal. And we're going to, you know, the group up here is going to be filing a very big case because of this water compact thing here that we're fighting with.
Well, it becomes, it just becomes kind of, I mean, it's unworkable in the long run. Sorry, add the one more,
yeah,
though.
Yeah, it is. Well, no, you're absolutely right, it's unworkable, but what it's doing is it's escalating the spread of tribal jurisdiction over our forests, our lands, our waters, our energy, and it's all with the blessings of these states and the Congress. And I don't know, and it's hard to change because that's that money wheel. The money comes right back in to the decision makers that are making these decisions. So our elected officials, by and large, here in Montana, I'll just use Montana, they're now serving 6% of the population, and the rest of us are just sucking soup. So,
jeez Louise, we're going to come back and finish this whole topic here. We probably won't finish it, but we're going to talk about it some more in the next hour. You are joining We the People Radio. We're here with Elaine Willman. Catch us online, wethepeopleradio.us. We'll be right back.
Yes, the electric Indian today.